I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Jules Krull, the founder of Krull, the world's leading risk management consulting company. Jules started the company in 1972 and is considered one of the pioneers of the modern-day corporate investigative and security industry. Welcome.
Thank you.
How would you define what Krull is today?
We're a series of specialized professional service activities that, generally speaking, you meet on a really bad hair day. When do we get called in to do investigations? Generally, somebody believes that something has gone wrong. Somebody has been defrauded. Somebody has stolen money. Somebody has embezzled. Somebody has stolen trade secrets. Somebody is counterfeiting somewhere and fobbing it off on the public. That's on the investigative side. Our restructuring business, that's a different business. But again, it's a business for tough times. So we have a team led by a genius named Stephen Cooper that ran Enron for 4 years when it was a bankruptcy. Steve and the team of 30 people were able to take the most complex bankruptcy in the history of the galaxy that had 2,000 separate purpose, special purpose vehicles and sort it out. Or our business where we're the world leader in the recovery of electronic evidence or emails. The whole idea of the business is to become the ultimate finder of fact or to provide consultative talents for difficult or troubled situations. Mm. And that's my description of what the business has come to stand for.
Was the company that Krull ultimately became the company that you founded in 1972?
Well, the company today is very different, and I did not envision this company. The genesis of the company was advising people on how to make their purchasing process more effective and how to make it more honest. But it was more narrow than that. It was focused on the printing industry where I had some experience in a family business.
What was your experience with the printing business?
My dad had a small printing company, and it was a tough business, very competitive, and it was a business in which payoffs were very common. As an idealistic young kid, I knew that was the last thing I ever wanted to do was to have to navigate the printing business. Well, my dad got sick, and I took a 3-month leave of absence and tried to negotiate being in the printing business. What was supposed to be 3 months became 3 years until we could sell the business. And that, what I learned during that time about the way business worked in that particular industry and what a difference a really good, straightforward person could make for a company versus people who were crooks and the impact they had, really was the idea, gave me the idea for the starting of Krull.
Where did you grow up?
I'm a Queens boy. When I was born, my dad was a milkman, and he literally drove my mom to the hospital in Brooklyn with me on board. So that's where life starts for me.
And you said that the printing business was corrupt here in New York City. Why do you think it was more corrupt than other businesses?
Well, it was... There were businesses across the United States, and ultimately I found out across the world, that where the people that were in the purchasing function, those people were not very well paid typically. And there was a tradition in certain industries where instead of getting a high salary, you got to make it up on the trade. And so you got a modest salary on the one hand, but it's like a waiter who gets a modest salary but makes it up with tips. In this case, the tips were more than tips. They were bribes. I used to say in the early days that purchasing agents were underpaid, underappreciated, and under temptation. It didn't make me very popular with the Purchasing Managers Association.
How old were you at the time when you decided to go ahead and start this business, mitigating risk or ousting corruption in the printing business?
Well, I was 30. I had just failed as an aspirant for public office. I ran for public office in Queens, again on an anti-corruption campaign, and Queens was the original rotten borough. But the opportunity for my first client came out of that campaign because there was a woman actually named Joan Fensterstock, and her husband worked at a company that became my first and only client. That company was Cadence Industries, And its best-known products were Marvel comic books.
Now, were you married at the time?
Yes.
And did your wife play any role in this new company that you
were creating? Oh, yes. Yes. It was just the two of us in the beginning. And so when I got my first contract and when I had to do my analyses, I wasn't a very good writer. And my wife is a great writer. We were a team until I could hire my first employee this second year of the business.
It's one thing to, you know, sleep and socialize and be with your wife, but then it's another to be with her throughout the day working together. Did you feel that there was not enough kind of limitations in the relationship at all because of that?
That wasn't our issue because my client gave me a desk at their office in Manhattan. And so Lynn was really working from home. So the only time we saw each other is when I got home at night and on the weekends. Mm. So we didn't have that 24-hour-a-day syndrome.
And was that enough to pay the bills in the first year? Or?
Oh, yeah. I'd come out of the campaign. We were broke. As a matter of fact, we had so little money during the campaign that I missed my last few car payments. So about a month or two after the campaign, we woke up one morning and my wife noticed the car was gone and she immediately assumed it had been stolen. I realized that I hadn't been making the payments for a couple of months. So, in fact, we found out the car had been repossessed. When I finally got the business launched in April, we had income the first year of $44,500. Last year, just to give you a sense of comparison, we did a little over $1 billion. But that $44,500 felt really good. My wife finally started to ease up on storing canned goods.
And potted chicken.
Yeah, there was a potted chicken, which traveled with us from 72 to 81.
I'm Jessica Harrison. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jules Krull, founder of Krull, the world's leading risk management consulting company. How did you move on from one client to, you know, several clients? What was the next step in that process?
My second client was New York Magazine. And I had come to know Clay Felker, who was the publisher. And then one of the people at Cadence took a job and became a senior executive at Penthouse Magazine, which also bought a lot of printing. He brought me in because he thought the way in which the printing was being purchased was not kosher, so to speak. And so by the end of year two, I had three clients. And so it began to spread as people said good things about our work. But it was very printing-focused and very purchasing-focused.
I want to go back to what you were saying before about being civic-minded. You were an assistant to the DA. You ran for politics for office in Queens. Now, when you started this company to get rid of corruption in printing, did you always have aspirations to have a public career later on? And so did you see this as sort of a means to an end? Or did you say, yes, this is the company that I'm going to be with forever?
Well, I never intended to go into business. I didn't have a very high opinion of business people. When I was in college, it was the period when John Kennedy had just become elected, and a lot of people were inspired by his vision and his persona. I graduated in 1963, which was the year in which he was assassinated in November of 63. And so when I look back at what I aspired to before I went to law school. It was a question of going to law school or going in the Foreign Service. So even in the early days of the business, for the first couple of years of the business, I thought this was a way to make a living. But as we had our second child and our third child and our fourth child, and as the business began to get some traction, I began to change my mind. And then what happened is I lost money for the first time. In 1978, I had a major receivable go bad. Mm. And that was scary because I had started the company with $500 in capital. And what I began to discover was that this idea of getting paid on the basis of performance, I was having mixed results. And I had a client in the hospital supply business, and the receivable was for $140,000, and this was in a year when the total revenues were only about a little over $700,000. and they refused to pay. And I also had a loan at the bank that I had personally guaranteed, that my wife had personally guaranteed, and the house was collateral. And so that was a really scary time. These personal guarantees can be really treacherous things, and if you can avoid it, you really want to try to avoid it because it puts absolutely everything at risk. And I know a lot of people who start businesses with no capital have to borrow. And when you borrow, they always ask for the personal guarantee. But my advice is sleep on it, take two aspirin, and come back the next day. And if you really feel that you must personally guarantee it, call me so I can try to talk you out of it. It's a really bad idea if you can avoid it.
So how did you wiggle your way out of that one?
Well, I had wonderful understanding bankers at Marine Midland Bank, which is today part of HSBC. And they said, listen, we think you'll be successful. You just have too much expense for what now needs to be a smaller business. So I was so relieved that that's what their attitude was. And they weren't going to call a loan and do all the things you worry about people doing. So I went back to the office, and we didn't have a very big organization at that point. And I said to everybody, well, we all need to, here's the story, we all need to take a reduction in our compensation. And I thought people handled it pretty well until the next day my two most senior people came in and said they were leaving, that they couldn't support themselves on that little money. And by the way, they didn't think I was going to be able to make it. Now, the business was a small business then. They voted with their feet and they left. So that was a very scary moment.
And when they said to you, well, we don't think you're going to make it, did you have any self-doubt that you didn't think you were going to make it? Or did you think, oh, these guys don't know what they're talking about?
Well, it did give me pause. But having said that, I felt that the idea made sense. I didn't have a lot of competition, and we were able to help pretty much everybody that gave us a chance. But the business, that did shake me up, not just their reaction, but the whole idea of losing money. And I pledged that I would move away from working on contingent fees based on performance.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jules Krull, founder of Krull, the world's leading risk management consulting company. We'll hear more from Jules coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Jules Krull, the founder of Krull, the world's leading risk management consulting company. Jules started the company in 1972 and is considered one of the pioneers of the modern-day corporate investigative and security industry. So I want to go back to the 1980s now. Your company took a turn for the better in that you were now representing potential corporate targets. Right. Could you talk to me about how that happened?
The next inflection point occurred at the end of the 70s when we began to investigate companies that were trying to take over other companies on a hostile basis, namely Sir James Goldsmith when he was trying to take over Diamond International, and when Victor Posner, he was trying to take over Foremost McKesson. And we worked to defend both of those companies, and that inflection point was huge for us. And this was early days of the takeover business. Today we call these people
shareholder activists.
Shareholder activists. In those days, they were known as asset strippers, takeover artists, green mailers, and a bunch of other things that are not able to be repeated on, at least on this station. And it turned out that Posner was really a phony. The inventory was phony. The earnings weren't accurate, and therefore he was trying to take over a very fine company with inflated stock. And ultimately, probably some 5 years later, he pled guilty to tax fraud. Those two cases were really seminal in our next stage of development, which was shifting away from beyond purchasing consulting and doing, quote, special audits and working for Wall Street.
What is your opinion about, you know, corporate raiders? Do you ever represent them, or is this sort of an ethical decision on your part to be the representative of the targets?
It really wasn't an ethical decision at all. It was a purely a business decision. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd been at this 8 years at this point, and developing the business was taking a long time. I was approaching my 40th birthday. When I looked around at my peers, I could take a certain amount of pride that I was working for myself, but it wasn't very rewarding financially. The company was not very well known. So I think it was pragmatic. The other matter, practically speaking, was that when people were under attack, they're willing to bring in whoever they consider is the best to help them solve that problem. People, generally speaking, are reluctant to pay for prevention. But when there's a problem and when there's pain, they are willing to invest very heavily at that point.
My guest is Jules Krull, founder of Krull, the world's leading risk management consulting company. Jules started the company in 1972 and is considered one of the pioneers of the modern-day corporate investigative and security industry. Your company has quite a high profile because, in addition to representing these target companies when these corporate raiders want to take them over, you've also done a lot of private investigations and investigations for governments. Can you talk a little bit about what some of those cases were?
Sure. It all began in 1985 when a friend of mine who was a congressman, a former congressman named Stephen Solars, had received information that Ferdinand Marcos had been stealing money from his country, including foreign aid that the United States had given. And so we worked with him. It was very successful. It was the only money, approximately $300 million. It was the only money that the Philippine government got back for a period of almost 10 years. And then began a series of other cases. So the whole idea of investigating former heads of countries began to get some traction. And so the next one we did was Baby Doc Duvalier, who, along with his family and his father, had plundered the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, Haiti. And we were hired by that country, by a succeeding regime, to investigate where the money had gone. And we began to investigate and found that he had apartments in Trump Towers and airplanes and all kinds of holdings in France and in Florida and in other places. And that got pretty widespread publicity, as did the Marcos work. Marcos, by the way, we did on a pro bono basis. In fact, we were supposed to get paid, for technical reasons, we were supposed to get paid a dollar for our work, but we never got the dollar.
You also investigated Saddam Hussein in 1990-1991. You were hired by the Kuwaiti government. Can you describe that?
Yes. It was August 2nd of 1990 when Saddam Hussein and the Iraq invaded Kuwait. The Kuwaitis had a very heroic ambassador to the United States, Ambassador Saud Nasser al-Sabah. And he and George Bush Sr. Began a campaign to try to recover their country. By October, they had concluded that they needed to find out where Saddam's regime's money was and understand and penetrate his procurement network. Procurement of weapons and also a dual-use technology and other things that could pose a danger to the region. And we began working on the case, looking for all sorts of evidence of their holdings. And there wasn't much known about it at the time in the West. We began to have a little bit of luck, and then the dam broke. And we began to discover hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in different places, stock holdings, ownership positions in major Italian companies, French companies, bank accounts, and so on. It was very successful. And that was another inflection point in the company that, you know, a thug still in power could be investigated by a private organization. And by March, they had been pushed out of the country.
Now, in terms of like the weapons of mass destruction, which were never found, could the U.S. government have hired Krull to have done some of that investigation and some of that intelligence research?
Well, they could have. In fact, we've worked on cases like that, typically not for the U.S. government. But you open up an interesting area because there are times when we are asked to look at things and it may not always be on the side of the United States government. And, of course, this is serious stuff. And the most dramatic example of that was when, after the bombings of the embassies in Nairobi and in the Sudan, there was President Clinton instructed our military people to send missiles into Afghanistan, into the training camps, and also into Khartoum. Well, in Khartoum, they sent a missile into what they believed to be a facility that was producing nerve gas and other dangerous drugs. Well, they made a mistake, and it was a place that was making it was a pharmaceutical plant. It was making baby formula. But the owner had had all his assets frozen. His plant was destroyed, and he hired us to look into it, claiming that he had no connection with Al-Qaeda, said he would open up his books and records. This is a case where you make a judgment about who you will and who you will not work for, and we said the condition for our working on it is whatever we found, good or bad, up or down, would be handed over to the U.S. government, and the chips would have to fall where they may. So don't hire us if you're worried about anything. And he said, I don't care. I'm clean. Here are all my books and records. Here's access to my now destroyed plant. And that was a case where we worked for somebody who had a grievance against the United States. But every once in a while, since we always hope that the company will stand for calling it as we see it, it was an important case in the history of the company, and it was led by one of our most distinguished people, a fellow named Norb Garrett, who was a former very senior guy in the CIA. And so he had to deal with taking on something that was a bit controversial.
You mentioned Enron and how you're helping to restructure it. And had somebody said, you know, Mr. Kroll, can you please investigate Enron? I think that there's something fishy going on here, before it was made public, do you think you would have been able to unearth all of the chaos and corruption within the company prior instead of after the fact?
Well, you know, there's always a lot more wisdom, as they say, on a Monday morning. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I think if you're given enough facts and you have enough time and you have enough budget, a lot of things are possible. I would like to think that we could, but the reality is that most of these things are uncovered by accident. They're rarely uncovered by the auditors. In fact, the auditors go out of their way to tell you that that's not their job. When things get off the rails, it's when people start doing things unnaturally. I, for one, believe that what we saw in the early 2000s was in part a reaction against the incredible bubble that got built during the dot-com era of the late 90s. And I think, without being an armchair psychiatrist, let me be an armchair psychiatrist, I think what happened is the fathers became jealous of the sons. I think people thought the whole idea of these companies being worth billions of dollars based on an idea and foo-foo dust, I think made the usually men in their 40s and 50s and 60s compete with these young people who'd come up with an idea and all of a sudden overnight were instant billionaires, on paper at least. I think there was outrage because it had great implications for their businesses, because if their stock prices were diminished because other stock prices were inflated, they were the subject of takeovers. They were the ones that were less able to attract capital. They were the ones less able to attract talent. So the implications were more than just psychological. They had practical implications.
Now, when you are doing investigative research, whether it's on a company or a country, and it is very covert sometimes, how do you do these things logistically? Or is there some special sauce that you're not allowed to disclose?
Well, most of it is not covert. That's the ironic part. I mean, most of the work we do is in the wide open. A skilled investigator is going to be more successful by being direct. People have a good sense of when they're being told the truth as opposed to getting tricky. It's a question of making it in the interest of the person you're speaking to and that you're interviewing to tell the truth. I think, by and large, people are more willing to open up to women than to men. Women are better listeners and are more effective at drawing people out. They're less threatening, typically. So over the years, we've had more and more women in the investigative role. Mm. Having said that, there are times when it's dangerous. In the mid-90s, we had an assignment for the UN. The UN was funding the reconstruction of Bosnia, and they were putting money into banks. And they began to believe that some of the money was being siphoned out of those banks and being siphoned out by the Croatian national parties to use for mischief and worse. And so we took an assignment on to go in and recover the hard disks and the personal computers and the records, and we sent in teams of computer, what we call computer forensics people, and we were to be protected by the Italian soldiers and French soldiers. Well, somebody tipped off the Croatian nationalists. And so the minute we were inside these banks, we began to get attacked by the mobs who had descended on these banks and descended on our people, and we had people injured. We had one man who was shot through a glass window, and he had hundreds of glass shards in his face. And the only reason he wasn't blinded was because he was wearing glasses. We had other people held at gunpoint for 10 and 12 hours and threatening to be killed. But that's rare. Most of the time, it's straightforward, it's open, it's direct, but there are those exceptions.
You have mentioned before that you view corruption like a cancer. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Okay. When you have an organization, whether it's a small organization or a big organization, people who cheat, people who take payoffs or give payoffs, it's almost always observed by others. So last week, there was a big insider trading case that was broken in New York that involved four of the leading investment banking firms in the United States. You saw a saga unfold where one person owed another person money and figured out the best way to pay it off was to give them information they weren't entitled to, inside information. And that began a chain of events that led to the arrest. I think it was, at the moment, it's up to 14 or 16 people. And people did all sorts of things. They mimicked the trading once some of them became aware of it because they knew, they saw the level of success. Some people traded off that. Other people discovered it and then began to blackmail people because they told them they knew what was going on. It's almost as if the cellular activity picks up and spreads. Sometimes it can remain very isolated, but not for long. And there are some people that see that kind of behavior and want to cut out the tumor. And there are other people who look at it and say, gee, that could be something that I could advantage myself. So I think corruption is a cancer. Until we began to investigate the Marcos matter, no one had ever, private organizations had never investigated former heads of state. We've done over 40 heads of state. And that for me is a really big deal because for those people to know that there's the possibility that somebody's going to come after them, at least it puts one more doubt in their mind as to whether they should be doing it or the extent to which they should do it.
I want to fast forward to the acquisition by Marsh & McLennan. They bought Kroll for, is it $2 billion in cash?
$1.9 billion in cash.
That's a long way from $44,500. You could buy a lot of cars with that.
That's true.
Do you feel in a way that even though you didn't lead a public life and you didn't run again for office, are you satisfied in what you've created in Kroll?
Within the Kroll business, we've been incredibly fortunate to attract individuals and groups of people who believe in the idea of what the company stands for, and that is to make the world a more honest place, to make it a safer place, and when companies run into trouble, work with them to sort it out, whether it be in a bankruptcy, whether it be in a security situation, whether it be in where people are in danger or a crisis. My lust for public life diminished a few years ago because I felt that in many of the areas that I had taken an interest, I could make a difference as a business person. So I feel pretty good about where we are, but needless to say, if you're, as are many of your listeners, entrepreneurs, you're never fully satisfied, or else you wouldn't be doing what some people think is a bit of a crazy way to make a living.
So your wife played a crucial role in the early days of the company, but what was her role throughout these past, 35 years?
She's been the constant throughout this. I mean, she's, we've had these endless thousands at this point, thousands of hours of conversations about that. And I think that's hugely important to anybody in business because running and owning a business can be a very lonely experience. She's been a beacon for me. Having a person whose only goal is to make sure that you succeed and you succeed in a way that you can keep your principles intact, in this case, my wife, is hugely beneficial. And I, to the point where I can't even imagine doing it alone. So it's been invaluable.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Welcome.
My guest has been Jules Krull, founder of Krull. Coming up, we'll meet Pat Helding, founder of Fat Witch Brownie. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Pat Helding, founder of Fat Witch Bakery, a company that sells brownies and other sweet treats, my pretty. They ship their brownies across the country and have a retail shop in Chelsea Market in Manhattan. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica.
You were a trader on the American Stock Exchange prior to starting Fat Witch. How did you decide to switch jobs and start a brownie bakery?
I really wanted to do something on my own. I don't think I can pinpoint it exactly, except that sort of building feeling that one has of, I want more satisfaction out of my career. And based on that, I also went through some personal tragedy, and I thought, you only have one life. Go do what you want to do.
Mm-hmm. How long were you working on the stock exchange?
Over 10 years.
Were you baking brownies for your colleagues, or were brownies in the picture at all?
They certainly were. I was baking for colleagues and bringing them in. And that's where the germ of the seed of the idea came for the business. Because people would say, those brownies you bake? I want to buy some. I'm having a party.
And where did you get the recipe from?
It was my mother's recipe.
How did you come to that decision ultimately to actually go through the process of leaving work and starting this bakery?
I was baking with somebody whose father had a bagel factory. And so we would use the bagel ovens, which are very different than a regular convection oven because they are almost like a Ferris wheel. They turn around and around. But we did a huge order for Goldman Sachs for Christmas one year, for the holiday season one year. And then I thought, this is a go.
And how did you get Goldman Sachs as a customer that year?
Because I knew some people from Goldman.
Where did you go from there?
I sent out 8 postcards to friends. I drew them and sent them out and said, I'm selling brownies. And that 8 postcards. And what I did do is keep diligent lists and, get it on a computer, get it into a database, and vary every single person who we sent to. And it's now probably a 250,000 database people.
How did you come up with the witch theme?
I had from trading, and as you might know, trading floors, one stands very close to someone else, and it's a lot of bumping and this and that. And I had a friend who had a laugh just like a witch. And one day she said, I'm pregnant. And I said, now I'll be standing next to a fat witch. And I just thought it was a funny name. I put it on the brownies. And we're not going to lie. They are fattening. We do use butter.
Part of the success, to me, in Fat Witch is the packaging and the whimsical artwork. Did you draw the logo?
Yes, I did. Packaging for anything, even if it's a consulting business, is very important. And I wanted each brownie to be the sense of you're getting a gift within a gift. And because most of our mothers bake brownies, I wanted something childlike in the drawing, in the logo.
Has the witch in the logo come alive to you? Like, do you look at her as kind of personified, or is it just, you know, this inhuman piece of art?
Oh, absolutely come alive. I mean, sometimes when I see 500 brownies lined up, it's almost like each one is moving, or, you know, they're a little bit different.
From 91 to 98, you were only known to Goldman Sachs and to your friends and family. Were you making enough to sustain yourself? Was this business break even at this point, or profitable?
It was barely break even. You know, I had some savings, and that's what I was using.
How much capital did you put into the business personally when you were starting?
Personally, about $25,000.
And how long did it take to finally reach some type of profitability where, okay, yeah, I could make a living doing this?
It probably took about 6 or 7 years. But, I mean, you know, I was getting some income. So it wasn't a money losing, but we weren't really, you know, we were barely eking by. I mean, when I first started, I thought if I could just get an order every day, it would be so amazing. Then it would be okay. We'll go forward. And that was like one order every day of the month.
How much was one order?
You know, it'd be like $30 or something.
And how much would it cost you to make that order and package it and sell it?
Well, you know, about $10.
So you're making $20 a day and you'd be happy.
Well, it wasn't a matter of being happy. I thought we could survive. We can build on this.
And do you have any children or anybody else to support financially?
No, I don't.
Was there any bank loan or anything in the process?
No. I mean, and you know, interesting that you bring it up, because when we were building out, one of the things we couldn't get was a bank loan. So without debt, you can't prove that you can take on debt.
What would banks say to you?
No, you know, you can't prove that you can grow. If your business has some debt and you have a track record of paying it back, you're actually in better shape than having no track record.
Were there times when you were thinking of leaving the business or doing something new?
Oddly enough, no. I mean, there were low moments, certainly, but I was determined to make this work.
When you say there were low moments, what do you mean by that?
I would say the lowest moment, you know, mentally was a rainy day in Manhattan. And to back up a little, we used to hand deliver things to businesses. And our delivery person did not show up. So in this pouring, pouring rain, I said, well, I'm going to have to go do this. And I had put on an old pair of running shoes that were just half falling apart, get to the place, drop it off. Blessedly, I didn't know anybody from this firm. You know, it's a Wall Street firm. I thought, if I bump into someone, die. But I didn't. Dropped it off. And as I was walking out, the sole of my shoe fell off. You know, I thought, this is just a low moment. Why am I doing this?
Now, I would think that it's kind of an isolating process. Did you miss any kind of socialization? Because you went from the floor of the American Stock Exchange, where you were in this throng of traders every day, and then you're just you.
That's a really good question. You know, yes, there was moments of feeling alone and alone on decision making. But I think I was always meeting people and always interacting with people that I didn't feel the pinch of worse. I think someone who's doing a consulting business at home, you know, might say, I just got to get out and go to a coffee shop so I can see other people. I never had that.
And then in 1998, you found your retail space in Chelsea Market. How did you go about finding that spot? Because Chelsea Market is kind of this popular location in New York City where there are a lot of artisanal bakeries selling their their brownies or their cookies or their wine or their fresh vegetables and produce. How did you come to land in that spot?
I happened to walk by it. I had been doing a lot of work and literally walking and pounding the pavement, trying to find space. I came across it and I thought, this is it. And I begged.
I begged
because they didn't have space at the time. And I said, when the next space that opens up, let me move in.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Pat Helding, founder of Fat Witch Bakery, a mail order company that bakes and ships brownies called Witches across the country. Pat also sells a book on her website called Hannah's Homework, an entrepreneurial story for little women. Were there any lucky moments in the early days that helped accelerate the business?
One thing we've always been lucky with is publicity. I have a whole file drawer of all the publicity we've gotten. So we're always sending out media kits and building on. So I think the lucky moments are getting on, you know, Oprah's Best Things list and CNN, and of course, this radio show would be the top.
Oh, so charming, Pat. I've heard that Japanese tourists love Fat Witch Bakery. I've heard stories that there are busloads of Japanese tourists who come and take pictures and buy Fat Witch brownies. Is that true?
Yes, it is. We have up in the bakery in Chelsea a sign in Japanese characters with a witch in a kimono.
And how did they come to know about Fat Witch Bakery?
This I don't have the answer for, but they come in droves. It's packaged very much in a way that the Japanese can understand. It's a little package, and our Fat Witch babies are the size that they're used to. It's a small thing.
And how about the taste of the brownies for Japanese people? I mean, I know in some Asian cultures, sweets are not as popular as they are in the United States. How does their palate react to respond to the brownies?
And in terms of the taste, chocolate is certainly a new thing to Asia, but making huge headways. In Japan, there is something called obligatory chocolate, where people give each other chocolate. I do fear that on shelves everywhere in Japan are little Fat Witch brownies, you know, just sitting there, and that people haven't eaten them because they've bought them for the packaging and the logo.
So they keep it on maybe their fireplace mantle in their living room as a piece of art, maybe.
Maybe.
Your brownies are wrapped like little presents. You know, you have them perfectly folded and with the sticker on top. Are those done by hand?
Right now they're done by hand. What I found very hard personally was trying to become more automatic and having engineers. It took me 4 years to find one, and I was not going to give up. I was not going to wrap these brownies the way everybody else did. Everyone said, oh, no, that's the only way you can do it. And I said, but we're doing it by hand with a diamond fold because it looks like a gift. And I thought, I want to meet my grandfather, who was a mechanical engineer back in, you know, the 1880s, 1900, 1910. When I met a man from Romania who's an American citizen, does all kinds of stuff for big companies. And he took us on. In Harlem, we'll have a computerized cutting thing.
You are now building an 8,000-square-foot facility in Harlem in New York City. How come?
We need more production space. We turn down business all the time. We have a waiting list of wholesale clients that want us.
And why in Harlem? I would think that Manhattan is more expensive than going to some of the outer boroughs like Queens or the Bronx. How did you happen upon this space in Harlem?
Certainly the city wants all manufacturing to be in the South Bronx and Long Island City. This was sheer luck to some degree. You know, I say it was luck, but the reality is I really pounded the pavement, you know, looking at lots. And this happened to be someone putting up a building that needed light manufacturing, and we happened to walk in at the right moment.
You sell a book on your website called Hannah's Homework, which is a book for little women to teach them about entrepreneurship. And the book is done in the style of a composition notebook that some of us remember when we were younger. It doesn't have the black marble on the cover, but it does have sort of that canvas a linen material going down the spine on the side. How did you come to write this book?
I wrote it because I feel passionate that we need to be encouraging people, and especially girls, about the possibilities of having an option of being an entrepreneur and being in business and being in business for yourself. And that there's a great deal of satisfaction that one can have of creating your own business.
The central theme of the book is there's this witch named Hannah who is in elementary school, and she doesn't want to do her homework. She wants things to come more easily for her. The book's message is, no, it requires a lot of hard work and no shortcuts. Do you
Exactly. You just nailed it.
Do you feel that you had any shortcuts in your work, in your experience opening this bakery?
I think
an autobiography?
No, it's not an autobiography. I certainly like to draw. You know, Hannah's passion is drawing and doing artwork. And she, like many people, not just kids, think, oh, you just get lucky when you have a business, or I'll just get lucky on this homework assignment. And it rarely happens. It's usually doing the work and the research to build a foundation.
I love there's a cat named Patience who sleeps on the gargoyle outside the window. Where'd you come up with the name Patience for the cat?
There's a lot of words in the book that are words, they're clues, they're thoughts that you need when you're running a business, and patience is one of them.
On your website, fatwitch.com, you have vintage photos by H.W. Helding. Who is H.W. Helding?
That's my father, and part of my inheritance was just boxes and boxes of photographs that he had taken from when he was young all through his life.
They are beautiful photographs. Have you done anything with those photographs commercially?
No, I haven't. I've had people ask to buy them. It's just a wide variety, mainly of people.
Strangers?
Yeah.
And there's a sense of nostalgia about those photos. And certainly, you know, brownies have a sense of nostalgia as well.
Absolutely. And I wanted to connect. Those photographs that are on the website are of New York City. And so I want to establish that we're a New York brownie. I think New Yorkers are pretty sophisticated. And if we can make it here, we can make it anywhere. So using those photographs was a sort of a throwback to both things, nostalgia and New York.
Speaking of nostalgia, do you remember ever being in your mother's kitchen while she was baking, whether it was the brownies or cooking some dinner?
Absolutely. All the time. It's a very fond memory of, you know, something warm coming out of the oven. Chocolate chip cookies. My mother made a great chocolate chip cookie, which I have to redo the recipe at some point with Fat Witch Bakery. Because she would put, being Danish, she would put coffee in the cookies. And I mean, when my mother died, people were calling me for about a year saying, you know, what made your mother's cookie so good? I said, the coffee.
Now, your brownies have 30% more chocolate than other traditional brownies.
Absolutely.
Deeper chocolates?
Yeah, we use a 71% bittersweet chocolate, which is a pretty high chocolate content. I think it's almost as high as you can go. Chocolate without sugar is almost impossible to eat.
It becomes homework.
Right. There you go.
You've been doing this for so many years, since 1991. Do you still have those initial satisfying moments?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things that's incredibly satisfying is when people walk in the bakery in Chelsea Market and they ask for witches. They're not asking for brownies. And I kind of step back and I say, I'll take 3 caramel witches and 2 walnut witches. And I say to myself, I made this up, you know. And it's just, it's a thrill. I would say most people are very generous with their praise and their thoughts. And it's a pleasure.
I think the public is also gracious and in a good mood because they're buying brownies. They're not buying insurance.
That could be. It's about a quality product with a sense of humor.
How many brownies are you baking per day?
At least 1,000 per day, usually around 2,000. In busy seasons, 10 to 20,000.
What do you think of the Duncan Hines or Betty Crocker brownies that are sold in supermarkets?
I think it's a solution. You know, if you've got a bake sale, that's certainly a solution.
Do you like the taste of those?
No, because they're filled with chemicals.
I love
lots
them.
Of, okay. Would you serve it as a dessert at a dinner party?
Well, now that you're making me feel guilty, I probably wouldn't.
Okay, good.
Well, thank you very much, my pretty, for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Pat Helding, the founder of Fat Witch Bakery. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. Next time on From Scratch, we'll meet Nick Lobel Weiss, co-founder of NYC Medics.
I feel like, in some ways, being sick is the great equalizer. We're all sick at one time or another, and we all have accidents. You'd find people that would be nasty to you on the subway, but once they're in trouble and you're there to help them, they would be so grateful. And that was very addictive, almost.
I'm Jessica Harris. Join us next time on From Scratch.